Welcome to another episode of Robbinsdale Revisited. Today, we'll continue to explore the 1930s. As the Great Depression dragged on, people in Robbinsdale enjoy recreational activities organized by the Works Progress Administration. In 1936, they also hosted the first Goodwill celebration, which included a parade and other festivities. The next year, the event included the dedication of the iconic Robbinsdale Water Tower. In 1967, the event was renamed as Whizbang Days. In 1938, Robbinsdale put on its big boy pants and graduated from village to city. The following year, the Robbinsdale Lions Club was founded as a service organization that supported the community through the following decades, especially during World War II. Now, president of the Robbinsdale Historical Society, Pete Ritchie, will tell us more about the 1930s.
So, sort of continuing our walk around town, of course, we know that Sipe and Gray, who is still in business here up on the corner of 42nd and West Broadway, they were a little further down, kind of where Pond America is now, and they had a funny little building that looked like an old house. And, of course, the Security State Bank of Robbinsdale, which became the first bank of Robbinsdale, was in the bottom of the Fawcett building. We had a few grocery stores in town. We had the Ruff Brothers Grocery. We had the Red and White store opens up in the 1930s. We've got the Clausen Grocery, and we got the Robbinsdale Grocery. So we've got a few. We have two lumber yards. We have the Hennessy and the Howard Lumber Yard, the Johnson Brothers Dairy, later the Purity Dairy. And we have three car dealerships. There was Samuelson, there was the Robbinsdale Motor Sales, and these are all kind of right there on West Broadway. One of them is right next to Captain Billy. On either side of the Fawcett building, you've got car dealerships. Of course, the Robbinsdale Meat Market at this time is going to be owned by the Hoffman family, and that one's still in business. And the Ben Franklin store, the Holsteins come to town and open up a little Ben Franklin store on the main drag, and that's there until the 1960s. Mrs. Holstein tended to be the one behind the cash register. You know, the place just thrived, and everybody's got a memory of the Ben Franklin store. And of course, we have the cash register from the Ben Franklin store right here in the museum. The wire shop was little dry goods and things ready to wear for children. A lot of people still have a memory of that one. And then down there, as you left town and you're heading toward North Minneapolis, not far from where Hy-Vee is right now, we had a place called Bofferding's Point. And remember, we had a whole bunch of saloons at the turn of the century that were down there too, on this little, the one dry piece of land that sat above Crystal Lake over on the west side. And Bofferding's Point was a gas station. Built onto the gas station was a little diner where they had music and dancing. And of course, they served Glick's beer. And Bofferding's Point was there until the 1950s, and it was actually taken down because the Terrace Theater wanted another entrance to its parking lot. And so when they acquired the building, they tore it down. But the saloon in the early 1900s there was also called The Point, and the boiler blew up in that, killed a couple people, and was a horrible tragedy. And I just can't help but wonder if the Bofferding's Point wasn't taking that name a little bit later on. So again, we're going to go back to the Westfall American Legion. The place was named for Gottlieb Westfall. It took us a long time to figure that out, but they would march out to a cemetery all the way out there near Corcoran once a year to honor Gottlieb Westfall, who fell in World War I. The historian, and it's great that these organizations had historians. You know, the Congregational Church had a historian. Westfall American Legion had a historian. In the case of the American Legion, the historian was Christensen, who was the son of the Christensen blacksmith over there on the corner of West Broadway and 42nd. And as you begin the decade, we have the commander of the American Legion is Julius Sessing. Sessing's owned a hardware store over there on Main Street, and it's about where Travail sits nowadays. So once a year, they would march out there, but of course, they also sponsored things like baseball teams, and we had the Robins, and they sponsored the Boy Scouts, and they put on everything from wrestling matches to dog races. And the dog races tended to happen in the winter. They'd be out there on Crystal Lake, and they would race across the ice. They'd be presented with a cup. And this went on right into the 1940s and 50s. And when you see old pictures of the Westfall post officers, the person that kind of always stands out is the commander, who was Raymond Winslow. He tends to either be pictured in a smoking jacket and a wheelchair, or else actually in bed. So we know that he was wounded during World War I. And George Christensen, his house was kind of just north of where Robbinsdale High School was on Regent. It was the old Christensen house that had belonged to his father, the blacksmith, and later to him. And of course, in 1931, they're sponsoring all sorts of athletic programs. That includes the dog derbies we talked about, wrestling, baseball. The Girl Scouts are also sponsored by the Westfall American Legion. They have an aviation program, and they teach kids how to work on airplanes and go through their engines. And they're doing tree planting along Crystal Lake. There are all sorts of conservation efforts where they're digging ditches to stop erosion. They're smoothing out the dirt roads where they can. The public entertainments, they're putting on plays. They're having the veterinarian bring, you know, do little clinics where you can bring your pet in. They're sponsoring kazoo bands, bands for kids. They have pancake breakfasts out where Grazier Park is now. And they bring in speakers. So, you know, the 1930s is going to be remembered for the WPA, Works Progress Administration, and the PWA, Public Works Administration projects, highway construction. You know, we built the senior high. They're getting gas lines. As we know, Gus Urban got the first gas lines. So they're laying gas lines with some of that WPA money. On April 19th in 1930, history repeats itself. When a bandit is fatally shot and wounded holding up the state security bank. And we actually have a sort of an account from somebody who was there. And this is the account from Joe Roche, who later became the mayor, and he was the bank president. And here's his report. He says, shortly after closing, a man, the robber, knocked on the door to get in. He had a gun and was allowed to enter. He ordered all the bank employees except one, Lawrence Chenard, into the bank vault. Unknown to the robber, Lawrence was in the toilet. As Lawrence exited the toilet, he saw what was going on, and he became an instant hero. He snuck out of the bank through the back door to the village hall to report the bank robbery. John Bloberger, everyone called him John B, because his dad was also John Bloberger, was on duty and immediately left the hall to stop the robbery in progress. Just before John B. got to the bank, the robber came out with a laundry bag full of money. The robber began to walk north on the sidewalk away from John B. John told him to stop or he'd shoot. The robber failed to stop, and John B. shot him, killing him on the spot. The bullet that killed the robber was a .45 caliber slug that came to rest in his shirt pocket. Roche's son had that bullet as a memento for years and years after that. And we don't know what happened to the bullet. It's not in our museum now. But this thing made up all the papers. Chenard was a hero. Bloberger was a hero. After the robber was shot, Ray Harrington, who was a police fingerprint expert, couldn't find a match for the bandit's fingerprint in any local files, and they were sent off to Washington, D.C., but no identification was made. The contents of a suitcase that was recovered from the Milwaukee station checkroom suggested the bandit may have been a college student, though his appearance was not typical of one. The robbery occurred during a busy evening, and, you know, Mrs. Bradley was leaving the motor sales office with a bag of Easter eggs and dropped them in all the commotion. Mrs. Samuelson and her young daughter were in a parked car in front of the shooting. Hans Hansen, a repairman, had just left the Walsh's Cafe, which later became the Wagner Cafe, and passed within feet of the bandit. Most of the merchants in town just thought the gunfire was an automobile that was backfiring. Mr. Keller, a jeweler, witnessed the shooting from his store across the street. He saw Bloberger retrieve one of the bandit's guns and hand it to Samuelson. Keller also observed Bloberger and a man named Haight carrying the recovered money bag back to the bank. The bandit was ultimately carried into the motor sales building. where he succumbed to his injuries. During the events of the night, Robbinsdale was shaken, but they were relieved because, remember, at this time we have no FDIC, and if the bandit had gotten away with the money, then that money was gone. There was no insurance that was going to take care of you. So Joseph William Roach, who was the bank president, gave his account to the police, and of course he was locked up in the safe too. And there you have, you know, pretty much the 1920s were bookended by these bank robberies. And in both cases, the robber was shot and killed in the process of the robbery. And the other account we have of the bank robbery was from Lawrence Chouinard. Remember, he was in the toilet when everybody else was ordered into the safe. And so he noticed that the bandit was pulling some guns, and he edged to the back of the room where the office work was done. And he knew he had to get help. He tried to open a window to shout for assistance, but encountered Tom Haight, who had been in another room unaware of the robbery. So Chouinard explained the situation to Haight, and the two are whispering back there, and they devise a plan. Haight locked the basement door while Chouinard ran to the village hall to find some help. And Haight went down the street to locate Officer Blowberger. Haight found Blowberger at Holmes' garage next to the bank, and Blowberger joined Fred Holmes and Francis Fuller and to approach the bank. As the bandit exited, Haight identified him by his cap, shouting, "That's the guy." Blowberger ordered the man to stop and put up his hands. Instead, the bandit began to run, pulling his gun and attempting to shoot under his arm. Blowberger fired twice, hitting the man near the heart. The bandit fell, dropping his laundry bag containing the loot and his gun, and Blowberger picked up the weapon and handed it to Walter B. Samuelson, who had arrived from the Shell station. Blowberger then entered the bank to check for additional suspects and ejected the empty shells from his revolver. So we've talked about infrastructure is finally getting put in place in Robbinsdale, and the biggest, most recognizable piece of infrastructure that we still have to this day, although it's covered with cell phone antennas, is the Robbinsdale Water Tower downtown. So in about 1936, the city council or the village council at that time starts arguing about, you know, we don't have a good source of water. We're paying $10,000 a year for a water contract with the city of Minneapolis. And it's just becoming ridiculous. So they decide that they're going to finally build a water tower, and they contract with this company called the Chicago Iron and Bridge Company. They need some land, and so Edith Robbins Daniels offers to sell them one of her lots downtown, or actually a couple of her lots, and they get it for $18,000. They dig a 500-foot deep well, and then they put the water tower up there at 41st Avenue North. 150,000 gallons is what it can hold, and it stands 160 feet high, so you can see it from just about anywhere. When you're coming in from the west, it tends to sort of dominate our little Robbinsdale skyline, and so it's still probably the tallest structure in the city, and we've added quite a few water towers since. We have the one that you can't see because it's obscured by parking ramps down there by North Memorial Hospital. We've got the brand new award-winning water tower over there by Grazier Park. So it's a huge piece of infrastructure. The city celebrates it with Goodwill Days. They put it on the cover of the Goodwill Days program. And in 1938, the mayor is still touting this water tower as we become a city. It's just been an object of civic pride ever since. It's been painted different colors. It's been green. It's been gray. It's been blue. And there's a faded robin painted on it right now as it starts to rust again. Whether or not it will ever be painted again, we don't know. But the city has said they're going to keep it, maybe use it for water pressure for the existing water system, and also just as a landmark. And my guess is they're still getting some money from the cell phone towers on it. So the Robbinsdale Water Tower, our iconic water tower, you know, the Osseo Tower, the Osseo Water Tower got a historic designation on the National Register of Historic Places. Ours is at least as attractive as that one. It's not quite as cute because it's so much bigger, but it's got that little tin hat on it. And maybe there's some way that we could save this thing for posterity, so future generations. There's always people talking about who climbed up the water tower. Our old volunteer here, Raleigh Haywood, used to talk about a man named Sam Chase, who was a flyer, and his family owned the Chase Hamburger Inn. And now he had climbed to the top of the water tower, and he'd been up there on that little tin hat and decided he could just walk along the edge of it and walk back and forth up it. And he slipped and fell, and Raleigh was sure he was going to slide down to his death, but he managed to hang on and climb back up and walk again. There's always a story of somebody climbing the water tower. In the 1970s, a man got kicked out of Adolph's for being rowdy and ornery, and he climbed up the water tower, and he demanded that the police bring him a six-pack of beer or he was going to jump off, and he stayed up there for about 2 days and just kind of had a standoff with police and refused to come down, and all he wanted was more beer and to be left alone and wanted the police to quit hassling him. He eventually did climb down, and I'm told that after spending some time sorting out his mental health, that he led a normal life after that. But all of us still remember the man that wouldn't come down from the water tower, and he had a big American flag that he waved around while he was up there. And it's just the stuff of legend. Who climbed up the water tower and what were they doing up there? We have a few photos from the top of the water tower in the 1950s. It's always been a great view. And for years, I thought they were aerial photos, but they're really just taken from the top of that water tower. And of course, we mentioned the other big public works at the time was Lilac Way or Highway 100 and Carl Grazier, who was the engineer for that. And he was a German immigrant. He only had one leg. The stories that are told about him, well, for one thing, Grazier Park is named after him because it was really close to his house. And why wouldn't you name the park after yourself if you'd put all this work in and you were supervising these giant crews of 4,000 and 5,000 men that were grading and building Lilac Way? You were supervising the landscaping of those Lilac Way parks. He was a bachelor his whole life. And at one point, he was spotted underneath one of the brand new bridges on Highway 100. And there was a woman much younger than him in the car. And when asked what they were doing, he had a very thick German accent. And he just explained that they were eating chocolates. And that was all we know about that story. But I just like it. I imagine, all of those work crews, all the rumors that were going around, what was old Carl doing in that car? But he was eating chocolates. Was it just a couple of years ago, his house went up for sale and it was, a nice 1920s bungalow with lots of woodwork and it sold right away. But I can't help but sort of, I was doing a little house shopping in my mind, and wouldn't that have been great to have been able to live in Carl Grazier's house? Another person worth mentioning in the 1930s was Otto Boydin, and his name is still up above what was the Nana Rosa's restaurant. You can see it carved there, and he ran a barber shop right there on the main street with another guy named Frank Dillenberg. That Boydin building has been so many things over the years. It eventually became our municipal bar because Robbinsdale, after World War II, decided that we were just going to do municipal liquor, and anybody who was serving hard liquor was going to lose that part of their license, and they could continue to have 3-2 taverns, although they were really limiting how many of those were going to be, and any liquor was going to be sold at the Muni Bar, which was there on West Broadway in Boydin's building for at least 40 years. So sort of, going back through Helen Blodgett's book, Robbinsdale Then and Now, the things that she highlights from the 1930s, there's lots of new canopies and large electric signs are going up along Main Street. Mueller's Drug gets one. Of course, the Robin Theater gets a new marquee, and new restrooms for men and women are added to the movie theater. A new ticket office is listed as another improvement. A bowling alley opens up on December 1939, on the 2nd, 9th, and 16th, the Robin Theater presents this cooking school, and it's held by some prestigious cook named Miss Anne Louise Olson of the Spry Research Kitchens. And among the prizes listed are 3 jars of cold cream provided by Mueller's Pharmacy, a whole ton of black onyx coal from Howard Lumber, and this onyx coal was delivered in this very strange-looking truck we have pictures of, and the entire truck is black. It's shaped like a bullet. It has that 1930s Airstream look to it, and it's the Onyx coal truck. So maybe that shows up at your house when you win this prize. You know, there's a chute that's going to load it down into your cellar because not everybody's got gas lines. There's still a lot of coal heat in Robbinsdale and coal fuel. And then you could also win a 6 months pass to the Robin Theater, 3 pairs of ladies' hose, silk, I guess. And you could get, and that was coming from the Elmquist Shoe Store, which was right there on Main Street and stayed there until at least the 1960s, 15 bags of groceries from the Clausen Grocery, 3 merchandise prizes from Bronze Bakery. I don't know what a merchandise prize is, but you could also get a GE electric roaster from Schuler's Shoes. And the admission to this cooking school was just 20 cents. So, I mean, the idea that our merchants are providing all these prizes, it must have been a big deal. You know, I think of the meet and greet that we have every year here on Robbinsdale's Main Street, the Chamber of Commerce puts on. And, you know, when you think about it, our hardware store sometimes provides tools that you could win. Of course, the Historical Society, we always provide a book or two that people can win, but they've given away flat screen televisions. You know, maybe it was like that. It seems like a big deal. A ton of coal, winning a ton of coal. I don't know how much a ton of coal would have cost then, but it seems like a great one. In 1939, the Robbinsdale Lions Club is organized. And, you know, right away they set up Lions Park, I know, which becomes a big picnic area. And of course, that's actually part of the Minnesota Highway Department property over there. But putting up picnic tables, putting up benches, you know, the Lions Club did then much what they do now. Of course, they had prominent members, Tom Howard, who owned Howard Lumber, helps found it. E.J. Cooper is in it, Milo Milky. And here in the museum, I can still look over there and see a great big cloth that has all Milo Milky's Lions Club pins from all the events that they had. But the Lions Club really puts themselves on the map when they work with Westfall, the American Legion, and they erect a flagpole down there, and this would be about where 42nd and Botanical Boulevard come together, or we would say 42nd and West Broadway, or 42nd and Highway 52. And so they hire this guy named Bossett, and he's the contractor. The cost is 500 feet. It's 50 feet high, and it has a 6-foot Kasota stone base. Of course, the other big project was the establishment of Lions Park on Lower Twin Lake, where Highway 100 and Botanical Boulevard come together, and they equipped it with tables and fireplaces. The flagpole sat there, you know, right into the 1980s, and at some point it was taken down, and there was a plaque that had the names of all the men that had served in both wars. And nobody knows what happened to that plaque, which is still bothering some of our Historical Society members. My guess is it was probably just melted down and went off. When they were digging for the base, though, somebody comes up with an agate, and they bring it to the Historical Society, and we've had it, you know, as long as the Historical Society has been around, and the only thing we know about it is that it was there at the base of that flagpole. And I should mention, Charles Wallace is starting to play a big part in Robbinsdale politics in the 1930s. Of course, he was elected mayor in the early 1950s. He was elected mayor again in the 1960s. He was also Captain Billy's barber for a while in the 1920s. First, he's elected as village recorder. Later, he's as an alderman, or as a councilman. And like everybody else, he served with the Robbinsdale's volunteer fire department. But he just plays a big role as we go through the 1930s, 40s, and all the way up into the 1970s. You know, in other strange news that Helen Blodgett brings us, we know that Bertha and Ruth Trump are traveling to Europe, and they're on a German ocean liner when hostilities break out, and they were taken to Rotterdam, where they could wait it out and get back to the United States. And then I think we're almost ready to go in the 1940s. In the late 1930s, a guy named Samuel Samuelson starts buying up some land. And first it's down there in McNair Manor, and he's developing a house or two. And he's built his own house, and then he's built a few other ones that he's sold. And he's a doctor in Minneapolis. And unfortunately, he gets himself in a little trouble in Minneapolis because he could no longer get a license to practice there. But he was an ambitious man and he wanted to build a hospital. And so he just went across the border into Robbinsdale and starts building his hospital. And of course, that becomes Victory Hospital. And that one opened, the construction's done in late 1939. And then it opens up in 1940.
Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Boyd. Robbinsdale Revisited is brought to you by the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Our little history museum is located at 4915 42nd Avenue North in the heart of Robbinsdale. We're open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 to 3. You can also visit us online at robbinsdale.org. You found this episode, so you know where to find the next one.
Bicycle into the city every Saturday to see our friends. Back home, sitting hand in hand, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, in Robbinsdale, in Robbinsdale. Ooh.
Our theme music is provided by Gabe Barnett and The Rounders.